Side 3. The Stars, My Destination. Continuing on page 83.
Yeah, crime pays. I got a little four-man job. Twin jet. Kind they call a Saturn Weekender.
Why Saturn Weekender?
Because a weekend on Saturn would last 90 days. She can carry food and fuel for 3 months.
Just right for me,
Foyle muttered. He writhed and controlled himself.
Sam, I want to rent your ship.
What for?
Something hot.
Legitimate?
No.
Then it's not for me, son. I've lost my nerve. Jaunting the circuit with you one step ahead of the cops showed me that. I've retired for keeps. All I want is peace.
I'll pay $50,000. Don't you want $50,000? You could spend Sundays counting it.
The needle hammered remorselessly. Foyle's body was twitching at each impact.
I already got $50,000. I got 10 times that in cash in a bank in Vienna.
Quat reached into his pocket and took out a ring of glittering radioactive keys.
Here's the key for the bank. This is the key to my place in Jobourg. 20 rooms, 20 acres. This here's the key to my weekender in Montauk. You ain't tempting me, son. I quit while I was ahead. I'm jaunting back to Jobourg and live happy for the rest of my life.
Let me have the weekender.
You can sit safe in Jobourg and collect. Collect when? When I get back. You want my ship on trust and a promise to pay?
A guarantee.
Quat snorted.
What guarantee?
It's a salvage job in the asteroids. Ship named Nomad.
What's on the Nomad? What makes the salvage pay off?
I don't know.
You're lying.
I don't know,
Foyle mumbled stubbornly.
But there has to be something valuable. Ask Jiz.
Listen,
Quat said.
I'm going to teach you something. We do business legitimate, see? We don't slash and scalp. We don't hold out. I know what's on your mind. You got something juicy, but you don't want to cut anybody else in on it. That's why you're begging for favors.
Foyle writhed under the needle, but, still gripped in the vice of his possession, was forced to repeat,
I don't know, Sam. Ask Jiz.
If you've got an honest deal, make an honest proposition,
Quat said angrily.
Don't come prowling around like a damned tattooed tiger, figuring how to pounce. We're the only friends you got. Don't try to slash and scalp.
Quat was interrupted by a cry torn from Foyle's lips.
Don't move,
Baker said in an abstracted voice.
When you twitch your face, I can't control the needle.
He looked hard and long at Gisabella. Her lips trembled. Suddenly, she opened her purse and took out 2 500-credit banknotes. She dropped them alongside the beaker of acid. We'll wait outside, she said. She fainted in the hall. Quat dragged her to a chair and found a nurse who revived her with aromatic ammonia. She began to cry so violently that Quat was frightened. He dismissed the nurse and hovered until the sobbing subsided.
What the hell has been going on? He demanded. What was that money supposed to mean?
It was blood money.
For what?
I don't want to talk about it.
Are you all right?
No.
Anything I can do?
No.
There was a long pause. Then Gisabella asked in a weary voice,
Are you going to make that deal with Gully?
Me? No. It sounds like a 1,000-to-1 shot.
There has to be something valuable in the Nomad. Otherwise, Dagenham wouldn't have hounded Gully.
I'm still not interested. What about you?
Me?
Not interested either.
I don't want any part of Gully Foyle again.
After another pause, Quat asked,
Can I go home now?
You've had a rough time, haven't you, Sam?
I think I died about 1,000 times, nurse maiden, that tiger around the circuit.
I'm sorry, Sam.
I had it coming to me after what I did to you when you were copped in Memphis.
Running out on me was only natural, Sam.
We always do what's natural, only sometimes we shouldn't do it.
I know, Sam, I know.
And you spend the rest of your life trying to make up for it. I figure I'm lucky, Jiz. I was able to square it tonight. Can I go home now?
Back to Jobur and the happy life?
Uh-huh.
Don't leave me alone yet, Sam. I'm ashamed of myself.
What for?
Cruelty to dumb animals.
What's that supposed to mean?
Never mind. Hang around a little. Tell me about the happy life. What's so happy about it?
Well, Quat said reflectively, it's having everything you wanted when you were a kid. If you can have everything at 50 that you wanted when you were 15, you're happy. Now, when I was 15, and Quat went on and on, describing the symbols, ambitions, and frustrations of his boyhood, which he was now satisfying, until Baker came out of the operating theater.
Finished? Gisbella asked eagerly.
Finished. After I put him under, I was able to work faster. They're bandaging his face now. He'll be out in a few minutes.
Week?
Naturally.
How long before the bandages come off?
6 or 7 days.
His face will be clean?
I thought you weren't interested in his face, dear. It ought to be clean. I don't think I missed a spot of pigment. You may admire my skill, Gisbella. Also my sagacity. I'm going to back Foyle salvage trip. What? Quat laughed. You're taking a 1,000-to-1 gamble, Baker? I thought you were smart. I am. The pain was too much for him, and he talked under the anesthesia. There's 20 million in platinum bullion aboard the Nomad.
20 million?
Sam Quat's face darkened, and he turned on Gisbella. But she was furious, too. Don't look at me, Sam. I didn't know. He held out on me, too. Swore he never knew why Dagenham was hounding him.
It was Dagenham who told him, Baker said. He let that slip, too.
I'll kill him, Gisbella said. I'll tear him apart with my own two hands, and you won't find anything inside his carcass but black rot. He'll be a curio for your zoo, Baker. I wish to God I'd let you have him.
The door of the operating theater opened, and two orderlies wheeled out a trolley on which Foyle lay, twitching slightly. His entire head was one white globe of bandage.
Is he conscious? Quat asked Baker. I'll handle this, Gisbella burst out. I'll talk to the son of a... Foyle!
Foyle answered faintly through the mask of bandage. As Gisbella drew a furious breath for her onslaught, one wall of the hospital disappeared, and there was a clap of thunder that knocked them to their feet. The entire building rocked from repeated explosions, and through the gaps in the walls, uniformed men began jaunting in from the streets outside, like rooks swooping into the gut of a battlefield.
Raid!
Baker shouted.
Raid!
Christ Jesus!
Quat shook. The uniformed men were swarming all over the building, shouting, Foyle! 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 Baker disappeared with a pop. The attendants jaunted too, deserting the trolley on which Foyle waved his arms and legs feebly, making faint sounds.
It's a goddamn raid,
Quat shook Gisbella.
Go, girl, go!
We can't leave Foyle,
Gisbella cried.
Wake up, girl, go!
We can't run out on him.
Gisbella seized the trolley and ran it down the corridor. Quat pounded alongside her. The roaring in the hospital grew louder.
Foyle! Foyle!
Foyle!
Leave him, for God's sake, Quat urged. Let them have him.
No.
It's a lobo for us, girl, if they get us.
We can't run out on him.
They skidded around a corner into a shrieking mob of post-operative patients, birdmen with fluttering wings, mermaids dragging themselves along the floor like seals, hermaphrodites, giants, pygmies, two-headed twins, centaurs, and a mewling sphinx. They clawed at Gisbella and Quat in terror.
Get him off the trolley, Gisbella yelled.
Quat yanked Foyle off the trolley. Foyle came to his feet and sagged. Gisbella took his arm, and between them, Sam and Jiz hauled him through a door into a ward filled with Baker's temporal freaks. Subjects with accelerated time sense, darting about the ward with a lightning rapidity of hummingbirds, and emitting piercing bat-like squeals.
Jaunt him out, Sam.
After the way he tried to cross and scalp us?
We can't run out on him, Sam. You ought to know that by now. Jaunt him out. Caister's place. Gisbella helped Quat haul Foyle to his shoulder. The temporal freaks seemed to fill the ward with shrieking streaks. The ward doors burst open. A dozen bolts from pneumatic guns whined through the ward, dropping the temporal patients in their gyrations. Quat was slammed back against a wall, dropping Foyle. A black and blue bruise appeared on his temple.
"Get the hell out of here!" Quat roared. "I'm done!"
"Sam!"
"I'm done! Can't jaunt! Go, girl!"
Trying to shake off the concussion that prevented him from jaunting, Quat straightened and charged forward, meeting the uniformed men who poured into the ward. Gisbella took Foyle's arm and dragged him out the back of the ward, through a pantry, a clinic, a laundry supply, and down flights of ancient stairs that buckled and threw up clouds of termite dust. They came into a victual cellar. Baker's Azu had broken out of their cells in the chaos and were raiding the cellar like bees, glutting themselves with honey in an attacked hive. A cyclops girl was cramming her mouth with handfuls of butter scooped from a tub. Her single eye above the bridge of her nose leered at them. Gisbella dragged Foyle through the victual cellar, found a bolted wooden door, and kicked it open. They stumbled down a flight of crumbling steps and found themselves in what had once been a coal cellar. The concussions and roarings overhead sounded deeper and hollow. A chute slot on one side of the cellar was barred with an iron door held by iron clamps. Gisbella placed Foyle's hands on the clamps. Together they opened them and climbed out of the cellar through the coal chute. They were outside the freak factory, huddled against the rear wall. Before them were the Trenton rocket pits, and as they gasped for breath, Jiz saw a freighter come sliding down an anti-grav beam into a waiting pit. Its portholes blazed and its recognition signals blinked like a lurid neon sign, illuminating the back wall of the hospital. A figure leaped from the roof of the hospital. It was Sam Quat, attempting a desperate flight. He sailed out into space, arms and legs flailing, trying to reach the upthrusting anti-grav beam of the nearest pit, which might catch him in mid-flight and cushion his fall. His aim was perfect. 70 feet above ground, he dropped squarely into the shaft of the beam. It was not an operation. He fell and was smashed on the edge of the pit. Gisbella sobbed. Still automatically retaining her grip on Foyle's arm, she ran across the seamed concrete to Sam Quat's body. There, she let go of Foyle and touched Quat's head tenderly. Her fingers were stained with blood. Foyle tore at the bandage before his eyes, working eye holes through the gauze. He muttered to himself, listening to Gisbella weep and hearing the shouts behind him from Baker's factory. His hands fumbled at Quat's body. Then he arose and tried to pull Gisbella up.
"Got to go," he croaked. "Got to get out. They've seen us."
Gisbella never moved. Foyle mustered all his strength and pulled her upright.
"Times Square,"
he muttered.
"Jaunt, Jiz."
Uniformed figures appeared around them. Foyle shook Gisbella's arm and jaunted to Times Square, where masses of jaunters on the gigantic stage stared in amazement at the huge man with a white bandaged globe for a head. The stage was the size of 2 football fields. Foyle stared around dimly through the bandages. There was no sign of Gisbella, but she might be anywhere. He lifted his voice to a shout.
"Montauk, Jiz! Montauk! The Folly Stage!"
Foyle jaunted with a last thrust of energy and a prayer. An icy nor'easter was blowing in from Block Island and sweeping brittle ice crystals across the stage on the site of a medieval ruin known as Fisher's Folly. There was another figure on the stage. Foyle tottered to it through the wind and the snow. It was Gisbella, looking frozen and lost.
"Thank God," Foyle muttered.
"Thank God. Where does Sam keep his weekender?"
He shook Gisbella's elbow.
"Where does Sam keep his weekender?"
"Sam's dead."
"Where does he keep that Saturn weekender?"
"He's retired, Sam is. He's not scared anymore."
"Where's the ship, Jiz?"
"In the yards down at the lighthouse."
"Come on."
"Where?"
"To Sam's ship."
Foyle thrust his big hand before Gisbella's eyes. A bunch of radiant keys lay in his palm.
"I took his keys. Come on."
"He gave them to you?"
"I took them off his body."
"Ghoul!"
She began to laugh.
"Liar, lecher, tiger, ghoul, the walking cancer, Gully Foyle.
Nevertheless, she followed him through the snowstorm to Montauk Light. To three acrobats wearing powdered wigs, four flamboyant women carrying pythons, a child with golden curls and a cynical mouth, a professional duelist in medieval armor, and a man wearing a hollow glass leg in which goldfish swam, Saul Dagenham said,
"All right, the operation's finished. Call the rest off and tell them to report back to courier headquarters."
The sideshow jaunted and disappeared. Regis Sheffield rubbed his eyes and asked,
"What was that lunacy supposed to be, Dagenham?
Disturbs your legal mind, eh? That was part of the cast of our FFCC operation. Fun, fantasy, confusion, and catastrophe."
Dagenham turned to Pristine and smiled his death's head smile.
"I'll return your fee if you like, Pristine."
"You're not quitting?"
"No, I'm enjoying myself. I'll work for nothing. I've never tangled with a man of Foyle's caliber before. He's unique."
"How?"
Sheffield demanded.
"I arranged for him to escape from Jouffre Martel. He escaped all right, but not my way. I tried to keep him out of police hands with confusion and catastrophe. He ducked the police, but not my way. His own way. I tried to keep him out of Central Intelligence's hands with fun and fantasy. He stayed clear. Again, his own way. I tried to detour him into a ship so he could make his try for Nomad. He wouldn't detour, but he got his ship. He's on his way out now."
"You're following?"
"Naturally," Dagenham hesitated. "But what was he doing in Baker's factory?"
"Plastic surgery,"
Sheffield suggested.
"A new face." "Not possible. Baker's good, but he can't do a plastic that quick. It was minor surgery. Foyle was on his feet with his head bandaged."
"The tattoo,"
Pristine said. Dagenham nodded, and the smile left his lips.
"That's what's worrying me. You realize, Pristine, that if Baker removed the tattooing, we'll never recognize Foyle?"
"My dear Dagenham, his face won't be changed."
"We've never seen his face. Only the mask."
"I haven't met the man at all," Sheffield said. "What's the mask like?"
"Like a tiger. I was with Foyle for two long sessions. I ought to know his face by heart, but I don't. All I know is the tattooing."
"Ridiculous,"
Sheffield said bluntly.
"No. Foyle has to be seen to be believed. However, it doesn't matter. He'll lead us out to Nomad. He'll lead us to your bullion and pyre, Pristine. I'm almost sorry it's all over. Or nearly. As I said, I've been enjoying myself. He really is unique."
Chapter 7. The Saturn Weekender was built like a pleasure yacht. It was ample for four, spacious for two, but not spacious enough for Foyle and Jiz McQueen. Foyle slept in the main cabin. Jiz kept to herself in the stateroom. On the seventh day out, Jizbella spoke to Foyle for the second time. "Let's get those bandages off, Ghoul." Foyle left the galley where he was sullenly heating coffee and kicked back to the bathroom. He floated in after Jizbella and wedged himself into the alcove before the wash basin mirror. Jizbella braced herself on the basin, opened an ether capsule, and began soaking and stripping the bandage off with hard, hating hands. The strips of gauze peeled slowly. Foyle was in agony of suspense.
"Do you think Baker did the job?"
he asked. No answer.
"Could he have missed anywhere?"
The stripping continued.
"It stopped hurting 2 days ago."
No answer.
"For God's sake, Jiz, is it still war between us?"
Jizbella's hands stopped. She looked at Foyle's bandaged face with hatred. "What do you think?"
"I asked you."
"The answer is yes."
"Why?"
"You'll never understand."
"Make me understand."
"Shut up."
"If it's war, why'd you come with me?"
"To get what's coming to Sam and me."
"Money?"
"Shut up."
"You didn't have to. You could have trusted me."
"Trusted you? You?" Jizbella laughed without mirth and recommenced the peeling. Foyle struck her hands away. I'll do it myself.
She lashed him across his bandaged face.
You'll do what I tell you. Be still, ghoul.
She continued unwinding the bandage. A strip came away, revealing Foyle's eyes. They stared at Gisbella, dark and brooding. The eyelids were clean. The bridge of the nose was clean. A strip came away from Foyle's chin. It was blue-black. Foyle, watching intently in the mirror, gasped.
He missed the chin, he exclaimed. Baker goofed.
Shut up, Jiz answered shortly. That's beard. The innermost strips came away quickly, revealing cheeks, mouth, and brow. The brow was clean. The cheeks under the eyes were clean. The rest was covered with a blue-black seven-day beard. Shave, Jiz commanded. Foyle ran water, soaked his face, rubbed in shave ointment, and washed the beard off. Then he leaned close to the mirror and inspected himself, unaware that Gisbella's head was close to his as she too stared into the mirror. Not a mark of tattooing remained. Both sighed.
It's clean, Foyle said. Clean. He did the job.
Suddenly he leaned further forward and inspected himself more closely. His face looked new to him, as new as it looked to Gisbella.
I'm changed. I don't remember looking like this. Did he do surgery on me, too?
No, Gisbella said. What's inside you changed it. That's the ghoul you're seeing, along with the liar and the cheat.
For God's sake! Lay off! Let me alone!
Ghoul, Gisbella repeated, staring at Foyle's face with glowing eyes. Liar! Cheat!
He took her shoulders and shoved her out into the companionway. She went sailing down into the main lounge, caught a guide bar, and spun herself around.
Ghoul! She cried. Liar! Cheat! Ghoul! Lecher! Beast!
Foyle pursued her, seized her again, and shook her violently. Her red hair burst out of the clip that gathered it at the nape of her neck and floated out like a mermaid's tresses. The burning expression on her face transformed Foyle's anger into passion. He enveloped her and buried his new face in her breast.
Lecher,
Jiz murmured.
Animal.
Oh, Jiz.
The light,
Gisbella whispered. Foyle reached out blindly toward the wall switches and pressed buttons, and the Saturn Weekender drove on toward the asteroids with darkened portholes. They floated together in the cabin, drowsing, murmuring, touching tenderly for hours.
Poor Gully,
Gisbella whispered.
Poor darling Gully.
Not poor, he said. Rich. Soon.
Yes, rich and empty. You've got nothing inside you, Gully dear. Nothing but hatred and revenge.
It's enough.
Enough for now. But later.
Later? That depends.
It depends on your inside, Gully. What you get hold of.
No. My future depends on what I get rid of.
Gully, why did you hold out on me and Jufra Martell? Why didn't you tell me you knew there was a fortune aboard Nomad?
I couldn't.
Didn't you trust me?
It wasn't that. I couldn't help myself. That's what's inside me, what I have to get rid of.
Control again, eh, Gully? You're driven.
Yes, I'm driven. I can't learn control, Jiz. I want to, but I can't.
Do you try?
I do. God knows I do. But then something happens and...
And then you pounce like a tiger.
If I could carry you in my pocket, Jiz, to warn me, stick a pin in me...
Nobody can do it for you, Guy. You have to learn yourself.
He digested that for a long moment. Then he spoke hesitantly.
Jiz, about the money...
To hell with the money.
Can I hold you to that?
Gully.
Not that I... That I'm trying to hold out on you. If it wasn't for Vorga, I'd give you all you wanted. All. I'll give you every cent left over when I'm finished. But I'm scared, Jiz. Vorga is tough. What with Pristine and Dagenham and that lawyer Sheffield. I've got to hold on to every cent, Jiz. I'm afraid if I let you take one credit, that could make the difference between Vorga and I.
Me.
Me.
He waited.
Well,
You're all possessed, she said wearily. Not just a part of you, but all of you.
No.
Yes, Gully, all of you. It's just your skin making love to me. The rest is feeding on Vorga.
At that moment, the radar alarm in the forward control cabin burst upon them, unwelcome and warning.
Destination Zero, Foyle muttered, no longer relaxed, once more possessed.
He shot forward into the control cabin. So he returned to the freak planetoid in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, the Sargasso planet manufactured of rock and wreckage, and the spoils of space disaster salvaged by the scientific people. He returned to the home of Joseph and his people, who had tattooed Nomad across his face and scientifically mated him to the girl named Moira. Foyle overran the asteroid with the sudden fury of a vandal raid. He came blasting out of space, braked with a spume of flame from the forward jets, and kicked the Weekender into a tight spin around the junk heap. They whirled around, passing the blackened ports, the big hatch from which Joseph and his scientific people emerged to collect the drifting debris of space, the new crater Foyle had torn out of the side of the asteroid in his first plunge back to Terra. They whipped past the giant patchwork windows of the asteroid greenhouse and saw hundreds of faces peering out at them, tiny white dots mottled with tattooing.
So I didn't murder them, Foyle grunted. They've pulled back into the asteroid, probably living deep inside while they get the rest repaired.
Will you help them, Gully?
Why?
You did the damage.
The hell with them. I've got my own problems. But it's a relief. They won't be bothering us.
He circled the asteroid once more and brought the Weekender down in the mouth of the new crater.
We'll work from here, he said. Get into a suit, Chiz. Let's go. Let's go!
He drove her, mad with impatience. He drove himself. They corked up in their spacesuits, left the Weekender, and went sprawling through the debris in the crater into the bleak bowels of the asteroid. It was like squirming through the crawling tunnels of giant wormholes. Foyle switched on his microwave suit set and spoke to Jiz.
Be easy to get lost in here. Stay with me. Stay close.
Where are we going, Gully?
After Nomad. I remember they were cementing her into the asteroid when I left. Don't remember where. Have to find her.
The passages were airless, and their progress was soundless, but the vibrations carried through metal and rock. They paused once for breath alongside the pitted hull of an ancient warship. As they leaned against it, they felt the vibrations of signals from within, a rhythmic knocking. Foyle smiled grimly.
That's Joseph and the scientific people inside, he said, requesting a few words. I'll give them an evasive answer.
He pounded twice on the hull.
And now a personal message for my wife.
His face darkened. He smote the hull angrily and turned away.
Come on, let's go.
But as they continued the search, the signals followed them. It became apparent that the outer periphery of the asteroid had been abandoned. The tribe had withdrawn to the center. Then, far down a shaft wrought of beaten aluminum, a hatch opened, light blazed forth, and Joseph appeared in an ancient spacesuit fashioned of glass cloth. He stood in the clumsy sack, his devil face staring, his hands clutched in supplication, his devil mouth making motions. Foyle stared at the old man, took a step toward him, and then stopped, fists clenched, throat working as fury arose within him. And Gisbella, looking at Foyle, cried out in horror. The old tattooing had returned to his face, blood red against the pallor of the skin, scarlet instead of black, truly a tiger mask in color as well as design.
Gully, she cried. My God! Your face!
Foyle ignored her and stood staring at Joseph while the old man made beseeching gestures, motioned to them to enter the interior of the asteroid, and then disappeared. Only then did Foyle turn to Gisbella and ask,
What? What did you say?
Through the clear globe of the helmet, she could see his face distinctly. And as the rage within Foyle died away, Gisbella saw the blood-red tattooing fade and disappear.
Did you see that joker? Foyle demanded. That was Joseph. Did you see him begging and pleading after what he did to me? What did you say?
Your face, Gully. I know what's happened to your face.
What are you talking about?
You wanted something that would control you, Gully. Well, you've got it. Your face, it... Gisbella began to laugh hysterically. You'll have to learn control now, Gully. You'll never be able to give way to emotion, any emotion, because...
But he was staring past her, and suddenly he shot up the aluminum shaft with a yell. He jerked to a stop before an open door and began to whoop in triumph. The door opened into a tool locker, 4x4x9. There were shelves in the locker and a jumble of old provisions and discarded containers. It was Foyle's coffin aboard the Nomad. Joseph and his people had succeeded in sealing the wreck into their asteroid before the holocaust of Foyle's escape had rendered further work impossible. The interior of the ship was virtually untouched. Foyle took Gisbella's arm and dragged her on a quick tour of the ship and finally to the purser's locker, where Foyle tore at the windrows of wreckage and debris until he disclosed a massive steel face, blank and impenetrable.
"We've got a choice," he panted. "Either we tear the safe out of the hull and carry it back to Terra where we can work on it, or we open it here. I vote for here. Maybe Dagenham was lying. All depends on what tools Sam has in the Weekender, anyway. Come back to the ship, Jiz."
He never noticed her silence and preoccupation until they were back aboard the Weekender and he had finished his urgent search for tools.
"Nothing," he exclaimed impatiently. "There isn't a hammer or a drill aboard. Nothing but gadgets for opening bottles and rations."
Gisbella didn't answer. She never took her eyes off his face.
"Why are you staring at me like that?" Foyle demanded.
"I'm fascinated," Gisbella answered slowly.
"By what?"
"I'm going to show you something, Gully."
"What?"
"How much I despise you."
Gisbella slapped him thrice. Stung by the blows, Foyle started up furiously. Gisbella picked up a hand mirror and held it before him.
"Look at yourself, Gully," she said quietly. "Look at your face."
He looked. He saw the old tattoo marks flaming blood red under the skin, turning his face into a scarlet and white tiger mask. He was so chilled by the appalling spectacle that his rage died at once, and simultaneously the mask disappeared.
"My God," he whispered. "Oh, my God."
"I had to make you lose your temper to show you," Gisbella said.
"What's it mean, Jiz? Did Baker goof the job?"
"I don't think so. I think you've got scars under the skin, Gully, from the original tattooing and then from the bleaching, needle scars. They don't show normally, but they do show blood red. When your emotions take over and your heart begins pumping blood, when you're furious or frightened or passionate or possessed. Do you understand?"
He shook his head, still staring at his face, touching it in bewilderment.
"You said you wished you could carry me in your pocket to stick pins in you when you lose control. You've got something better than that, Gully. Or worse, poor darling. You've got your face."
"No," he said. "No."
"You can't ever lose control, Gully. You'll never be able to drink too much, eat too much, love too much, hate too much. You'll have to hold yourself with an iron grip."
"No,"
he insisted desperately.
"It can be fixed. Baker can do it, or somebody else. I can't walk around afraid to feel anything because it'll turn me into a freak."
"I don't think this can be fixed, Gully."
"Skin graft?"
"No. The scars are too deep for graft. You'll never get rid of this stigmata, Gully. You'll have to learn to live with it."
Foyle flung the mirror from him in sudden rage, and again the blood-red mask flared up under his skin. He lunged out of the main cabin to the main hatch, where he pulled his spacesuit down and began to squirm into it.
"Gully, where are you going? What are you going to do?"
"Get tools," he shouted. "Tools for the safe."
"Where?"
"In the asteroid. They've got dozens of warehouses stuffed with tools from wrecked ships. There have to be drills there, everything I need. Don't come with me. There may be trouble." "How is my goddamned face now? Showing it? By Christ, I hope there is trouble."
He corked his suit and went into the asteroid. He found a hatch separating the habited core from the outer void. He banged on the door. He waited and banged again, and continued the imperious summons until at last the hatch was opened. Arms reached out and yanked him in, and the hatch was closed behind him. It had no airlock. He blinked in the light and scowled at Joseph and his innocent people gathering before him, their faces hideously decorated. And he knew that his own face must be flaming red and white, for he saw Joseph start, and he saw the devil mouth shape the syllables. No, Mad. Foyle strode through the crowd, scattering them brutally. He smashed Joseph with a backhand blow from his mailed fist. He searched through the inhabited corridors, recognizing them dimly, and he came at last to the chamber, half-natural cave, half-antique hull, where the tools were stored. He rooted and ferreted, gathering up drills, diamond bits, acids, thermites, crystallants, dynamite jellies, fuses. In the gently revolving asteroid, the gross weight of the equipment was reduced to less than 100 pounds. He lumped it into a mass, roughly bound it together with cable, and started out of the store cave. Joseph and his scientific people were waiting for him, like fleas waiting for a wolf. They darted at him, and he battered through them, harried, delighted, savage. The armor of his spacesuit protected him from their attacks, and he went down the passages searching for a hatch that would lead out into the void. Gisbella's voice came to him, tinny on the earphones and agitated.
Gully, can you hear me? This is Jiz. Gully, listen to me.
Go ahead.
Another ship came up 2 minutes ago. It's drifting on the other side of the asteroid.
What?
It's marked with yellow and black colors like a hornet.
Dagenham's colors.
Then we've been followed.
What else? Dagenham's probably had a fix on me ever since we busted out of Jouffre Martel. I was a fool not to think of it. We've got to work fast, Jiz. Cork up in a suit and meet me aboard Nomad. The purser's room. Go, girl.
But Gully...
Sign off. They may be monitoring our wave band. Go.
He drove through the asteroid, reached a barred hatch, broke through the guard before it, smashed it open, and went into the void of the outer passages. The scientific people were too desperate getting the hatch closed to stop him. But he knew they would follow him. They were raging. He hauled the bulk of his equipment through twists and turns to the wreck of the Nomad. Gisbella was waiting for him in the purser's room. She made a move to turn on her microwave set, and Foyle stopped her. He placed his helmet against hers and shouted,
No short wave. They'll be monitoring, and they'll locate us by DF. You can hear me like this, can't you?
She nodded.
All right. We've got maybe an hour before Dagenham locates us. We've got maybe an hour before Joseph and his mob come after us. We're in a hell of a jam. We've got to work fast.
She nodded again.
No time to open the safe and transport the bullion.
If it's there...
Dagenham's here, isn't he? That's proof it's there. We'll have to cut the whole safe out of the Nomad and get it into the Weekender. Then we blast.
But...
Just listen to me and do what I say. Go back to the Weekender. Empty it out. Jettison everything we don't need. All supplies except emergency rations.
Why?
Because I don't know how many tons this safe weighs, and the ship may not be able to handle it when we come back to gravity. We've got to make allowances in advance. It'll mean a tough trip back, but it's worth it. Strip the ship. Fast. Go, girl. Go.
He pushed her away and, without another glance in her direction, attacked the safe. It was built into the structural steel of the hull, a massive steel ball some 4 feet in diameter. It was welded to the strakes and ribs of the Nomad at 12 different spots. Foyle attacked each weld in turn with acids, drills, thermite, and refrigerants. He was operating on the theory of structural strain. To heat, freeze, and etch the steel until its crystalline structure was distorted and its physical strength destroyed. He was fatiguing the metal. Gisbella returned, and he realized that 45 minutes had passed. He was dripping and shaking, but the globe of the safe hung free of the hull with a dozen rough knobs protruding from its surface. Foyle motioned urgently to Gisbella, and she strained her weight against the safe with him. They could not budge its mass together. As they sank back in exhaustion and despair, a quick shadow eclipsed the sunlight pouring through the rents in the Nomad hull. They stared up. A spaceship was circling the asteroid less than a quarter of a mile off. Foyle placed his helmet against Gisbella's.
Dagenham, he gasped. Looking for us. Probably got a crew down here combing for us, too. Soon as they talk to Joseph, they'll be here.
Oh, golly,
We've still got a chance. Maybe they won't spot Sam's weak end there until they've made a couple of revolutions. It's hidden in that crater. Maybe we can get the safe aboard in the meantime.
How, Gully?
I don't know, damn it, I don't know.
He pounded his fists together in frustration.
I'm finished.
Couldn't we blast it out?
Blast? What, bombs instead of brains? Is this Mental McQueen speaking?
Listen, blast it with something explosive. That would act like a rocket jet. Give it a thrust.
Yes, I've got that. But then what? How do we get it into the ship, girl? Can't keep on blasting. Haven't got time.
No, we bring the ship to the safe.
What?
Blast the safe straight out into space. Then bring the ship around and let the safe sail right into the main hatch, like catching a ball in your hat, see?
He saw.
By God, Jez, we can do it.
Foyle leaped to the pile of equipment and began sorting out sticks of dynamite gelatin, fuses and caps.
We'll have to use the short wave. One of us stays with the safe, one of us pilots the ship. Man with a safe talks the man with a ship into position, right?
Right. You'd better pilot, Gully. I'll do the talking.
He nodded, fixing explosive to the face of the safe, attaching caps and fuses. Then he placed his helmet against hers.
Vacuum fuses, Jez. Time for 2 minutes. When I give the word by short wave, just pull off the fuse heads and get the hell out of the way, right?
Right.
Stay with the safe. Once you've talked it into the ship, come right after it. Don't wait for anything. It's going to be close.
He thumped her shoulder and returned to the Weekender. He left the outer hatch open and the inner door of the airlock as well. The ship's air emptied out immediately. Airless and stripped by Gisbella, it looked dismal and forlorn. Foyle went directly to the controls, sat down and switched on his microwave set.
Stand by, he muttered. I'm coming out now.
He ignited the jets, blew the laterals for 3 seconds, and then the forwards. The Weekender lifted easily, shaking debris from her back and sides like a whale surfacing. As she slid up and back, Foyle called,
Dynamite, Jez! Now!
There was no blast. There was no flash. A new crater opened in the asteroid below him, and a flower of rubble sprang upward, rapidly outdistancing a dull steel ball that followed leisurely, turning in a weary spin.
Ease off,
Gisbella's voice came cold and competent over the earphones. You're backing too fast. And, incidentally, trouble's arrived. He braked with the rear jets, looking down in alarm. The surface of the asteroid was covered with a swarm of hornets. They were Dagenham's crew in yellow and black banded spacesuits. They were buzzing around a single figure in white that dodged and spun and eluded them. It was Gisbella.
Steady as you go,
Gis said quietly, although he could hear how hard she was breathing.
Ease off a little more. Roll a quarter turn.
He obeyed her almost automatically, still watching the struggle below. The flank of the Weekender cut off any view of the trajectory of the safe as it approached him, but he could still see Gisbella and Dagenham's men. She ignited her suit rocket. He could see the tiny spurt of flame shoot out from her back and came sailing up from the surface of the asteroid. A score of flames burst out from the backs of Dagenham's men as they followed. Half a dozen dropped the pursuit of Gisbella and came up after the Weekender.
It's going to be close, Gully.
Gisbella was gasping now, but her voice was still steady.
Dagenham's ship came down on the other side, but they've probably signaled him by now, and he'll be on his way. Hold your position, Gully. About 10 seconds now.
The hornets closed in and engulfed the tiny white suit.
Foyle, can you hear me? Foyle?
Dagenham's voice came in fuzzily and finally cleared.
This is Dagenham calling on your band. Come in, Foyle. Jez, can you get clear of them?
Hold your position, Gully. There she goes. It's a hole-in-one, son.
A crushing shock racked the Weekender as the safe, moving slowly but massively, rammed into the main hatch. At the same moment, the white-suited figure broke out of the cluster of yellow wasps. It came rocketing up to the Weekender, hotly pursued.
Come on, Jez, come on,
Foyle howled.
Come, girl, come.
As Gisbella disappeared from sight behind the flank of the Weekender, Foyle set controls and prepared for top acceleration.
Foyle, will you answer me? This is Dagenham speaking. To hell with you, Dagenham, Foyle shouted. Give me the word when you're aboard, Jez, and hold on.
I can't make it, Gully.
Come on, girl.
I can't get aboard. The safe's blocking the hatch. It's wedged in halfway.
Jizz!
There's no way in, I tell you, she cried in despair. I'm blocked out.
He stared around wildly. Dagenham's men were boarding the hull of the Weekender with the menacing purpose of professional raiders. Dagenham's ship was lifting over the brief horizon of the asteroid on a dead course for him. His head began to spin.
Oil, you're finished. You and the girl. But I'll offer a deal.
Gully, help me. Do something, Gully. I'm lost.
Vorka,
he said in a strangled voice. He closed his eyes and tripped the controls. The tail jets roared. The Weekender shook and shuddered forward. It broke free of Dagenham's borders, of Gisbella, of warnings and pleas. It pressed Foyle back into the pilot's chair with a blackout of 10G acceleration, an acceleration that was less pressing, less painful, less treacherous than the passion that drove him. And as he passed from sight, there rose up on his face the blood-red stigmata of his possession. Part 2. With a heart of furious fancies whereof I am commander, with a burning spear and a horse of air to the wilderness I wander. With a night of ghosts and shadows I summoned M. to tourney. 10 leagues beyond the wide world's end, methinks it is no journey. Tom a Bedlam. Chapter 8. The old year soured as pestilence poisoned the planets. The war gained momentum and grew from a distant affair of romantic raids and skirmishes in space to a holocaust in the making. It became evident that the last of the world wars was done and the first of the solar wars had begun. The belligerents slowly massed men and materiel for the havoc. The outer satellites introduced universal conscription, and the inner planets perforce followed suit. Industries, trades, sciences, skills, and professions were drafted. Regulations and oppressions followed. The armies and navies requisitioned and commanded. Commerce obeyed, for this war, like all wars, was the shooting phase of a commercial struggle. But populations rebelled, and draft jaunting and labor jaunting became critical problems. Spy scares and invasion scares spread. The hysterical became informers and lynchers. An ominous foreboding paralyzed every home from Baffin Island to the Falklands. The dying year was enlivened only by the advent of the four-mile circus. This was the popular nickname for the grotesque entourage of Jeffrey Fourmile of Ceres, a wealthy young buffoon from the largest of the asteroids. Fourmile of Ceres was enormously rich. He was also enormously amusing. He was the classic nouveau riche of all time. His entourage was a cross between a country circus and the comic court of a Bulgarian kinglet, as witnessed this typical arrival in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Early in the morning, a lawyer, wearing the stovepipe hat of a legal clan, appeared with a list of campsites in his hand and a small fortune in his pocket. He settled on a 4-acre meadow facing Lake Michigan and rented it for an exorbitant fee. He was followed by a gang of surveyors from the Mason and Dixon clan. In 20 minutes, the surveyors had laid out a campsite, and the word was spread that the 4-mile circus was arriving. Locals from Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota came to watch the fun. 20 roustabouts jaunted in, each carrying a tent pack on his back. There was a mighty overture of bawled orders, shouts, curses, and the tortured scream of compressed air. 20 giant tents ballooned upward, their lac and latex surfaces gleaming as they dried in the winter sun. The spectators cheered. A 6-motor helicopter drifted down and hovered over a giant trampoline. Its belly opened and a cascade of furnishings came down. Servants, valets, chefs, and waiters jaunted in. They furnished and decorated the tents. The kitchens began smoking, and the odor of frying, broiling, and baking pervaded the camp. 4 miles, private police were already on duty, patrolling the 4 acres, keeping the huge crowd of spectators back. Then, by plane, by car, by bus, by truck, by bike, and by jaunt, came 4 miles entourage. Librarians and books, scientists and laboratories, philosophers, poets, athletes. Racks of swords and sabers were set up, and judo mats and a boxing ring. A 50-foot pool was sunk in the ground and filled by pump from the lake. An interesting altercation arose between two beefy athletes as to whether the pool should be warmed for swimming or frozen for skating. Musicians, actors, jugglers, and acrobats arrived. The uproar became deafening. A crew of mechanics melted a grease pit and began revving up 4 miles' collection of vintage diesel harvesters. Last of all came the camp followers, wives, daughters, mistresses, whores, beggars, chiselers, and grafters. By mid-morning, the roar of the circus could be heard for 4 miles, hence the nickname. At noon, 4 Mile of Ceres arrived with a display of conspicuous transportation so outlandish that it had been known to make 7-year melancholics laugh. A giant amphibian thrummed up from the south and landed on the lake. An LST barge emerged from the plain and droned across the water to the shore. Its forward wall banged down into a drawbridge, and out came a 20th century staff car. Wonder piled on wonder for the delighted spectators, for the staff car drove a matter of 20 yards to the center of camp and then stopped. What can possibly come next? Bike? No, roller skates. He'll come out on a pogo stick. 4 Mile capped their wildest speculations. The muzzle of a circus cannon thrust up from the staff car. There was a bang of a black powder explosion, and 4 Mile of Ceres was shot out of the cannon in a graceful arc to the very door of his tent, where he was caught in a net by 4 valets. The applause that greeted him could be heard for 6 miles. 4 Mile climbed onto his valet's shoulders and motioned for silence.
"Friends, Romans, countrymen,"
4 Mile began earnestly,
"lend me your ears, Shakespeare. 1564, 1616. Damn!"
4 white doves shook themselves out of 4 Mile's sleeves and fluttered away. He regarded them with astonishment, then continued,
"Friends, greetings, salutations, bonjour, bon temps, bon vivant, bon voyage, bon..."
What the hell?
4 Mile's pockets caught fire and rocketed forth Roman candles. He tried to put himself out. Streamers and confetti burst from him.
"Friends, shut up, I'll get this speech straight. Quiet. Friends..."
4 Mile looked down at himself in dismay. His clothes were melting away, revealing lurid scarlet underwear.
"Kleinman,"
he bellowed furiously.
"Kleinman, what's happened to your goddamn hypno-training?"
A hairy head thrust out of a tent.
"You studied for this speech last night, 4 Mile?"
"Damn right. For 2 hours I studied. Never took my head out of the hypno-oven. Kleinman on prestidigitation."
No, the hairy man bawled. "How many times must I tell you? Prestidigitation is not speech-making. It's magic. Dummkopf, you have the wrong hypnosis taken."
The scarlet underwear began melting. 4 Mile toppled from the shoulders of his shaking valets and disappeared within his tent. There was a roar of laughter and cheering, and the 4 Mile circus ripped into high gear. The kitchens sizzled and smoked. There was a perpetuity of eating and drinking. The music never stopped. The vaudeville never ceased. Inside his tent, 4 Mile changed his clothes, changed his mind, changed again, undressed again, kicked his valets, and called for his tailor in a bastard tongue of French, Mayfair, and affectation. Halfway into a new suit, he recollected he had neglected to bathe. He slapped his tailor, ordered 10 gallons of scent to be decanted into the pool, and was stricken with poetic inspiration. He summoned his resident poet.
"Take this down,"
4 Mile commanded.
"Le roi est mort. Le..." "Wait. What rhymes to moon?"
"June," his poet suggested. "Croon, soon, dune. Loon, noon, rune, tune, boon."
"I forgot my experiment,"
4 Mile exclaimed.
"Dr. Boone, Dr. Boone."
Half naked, he rushed pell-mell into the laboratory, where he blew himself and Dr. Boone, his resident chemist, halfway across the tent. As the chemist attempted to raise himself from the floor, he found himself seized in a most painful and embarrassing stranglehold.
"Noguchi!"
4 Mile shouted.
"Hi, Noguchi!
I just invented a new judo hold.
Fourmile stood up, lifted the suffocating chemist, and jaunted to the judo mat, where the little Japanese inspected the hold and shook his head.
No, please, he hissed politely. Pressure on the windpipe are not perpetually lethal. I show you, please.
He seized the dazed chemist, whirled him, and deposited him on the mat in a position of perpetual self-strangulation.
You observe, please, Fourmile.
But Fourmile was in the library, bludgeoning his librarian over the head with blocks, thus sexual leben, 8 pounds 9 ounces, because that unhappy man could produce no text on the manufacture of perpetual motion machines. He rushed to his physics laboratory, where he destroyed an expensive chronometer to experiment with cogwheels, jaunted to the bandstand, where he seized a baton and led the orchestra into confusion, put on skates and fell into the scented swimming pool, was hauled out, swearing fulminously at the lack of ice, and was heard to express a desire for solitude.
I wish to commute with myself, Fourmile said, kicking his valets in all directions.
He was snoring before the last of them limped to the door and closed it behind him. The snoring stopped, and Foyle arose.
That ought to hold them for today, he muttered,
and went into his dressing room. He stood before a mirror, took a deep breath, and held it, meanwhile watching his face. At the expiration of 1 minute, it was still untainted. He continued to hold his breath, maintaining a rigid control over pulse and muscle, mastering the strain with iron calm. At 2 minutes and 20 seconds, the stigmata appeared, blood-red. Foyle let out his breath. The tiger mask faded.
Better, he murmured. Much better. The old fakir was right. Yoga is the answer. Control, pulse, breath, bowels, brains.
He stripped and examined his body. He was in magnificent condition, but his skin still showed delicate silver seams in a network from neck to ankles. It looked as though someone had carved an outline of the nervous system into Foyle's flesh. The silver seams were the scars of an operation that had not yet faded. That operation had cost Foyle a 200,000-credit bribe to the chief surgeon of the Mars Commando Brigade and had transformed him into an extraordinary fighting machine. Every nerve plexus had been rewired. Microscopic transistors and transformers had been buried in muscle and bone. A minute platinum outlet showed at the base of his spine. To this, Foyle affixed a power pack the size of a pea and switched it on. His body began an internal electronic vibration that was almost mechanical.
More machine than man, he thought.
He dressed, rejected the extravagant apparel of Fourmile of Ceres for the anonymous black coverall of action. He jaunted to Robin Winsbury's apartment in the lonely building amidst the Wisconsin pines. It was the real reason for the advent of the Fourmile Circus in Green Bay. He jaunted and arrived in darkness and empty space, and immediately plummeted down.
Wrong coordinates, he thought. Misjaunted?
The broken end of a rafter dealt him a bruising blow, and he landed heavily on a shattered floor upon the putrefying remains of a corpse.
Foyle leaped up in calm revulsion. He pressed hard with his tongue against his right upper first molar. The operation that had transformed half his body into an electronic machine had located the control switchboard in his teeth. Foyle pressed a tooth with his tongue, and the peripheral cells of his retina were excited into emitting a soft light. He looked down 2 pale beams at the corpse of a man. The corpse lay in the apartment below Robin Winsbury's flat. It was gutted. Foyle looked up. Above him was a 10-foot hole where the floor of Robin's living room had been. The entire building stank of fire, smoke, and rot.
Jacked, Foyle said softly. This place has been jacked. What happened?
The jaunting age had crystallized the hobos, tramps, and vagabonds of the world into a new class. They followed the night from east to west, always in darkness, always in search of loot, the leavings of disaster, carrion. If earthquake shattered a warehouse, they were jacking it the following night. If fire opened a house or explosion split the defenses of a shop, they jaunted in and scavenged. They called themselves jack jaunters.
They were jackals. Foyle climbed up through the wreckage to the corridor on the floor above. The jack-jaunters had a camp there. A whole calf roasted before a fire which sparked up to the sky through a rent in the roof. There were a dozen men and three women around the fire, rough, dangerous, jabbering in the cockney rhyming slang of the jackals. They were dressed in mismatched clothes and drinking potato beer from champagne glasses. An ominous growl and anger and terror met Foyle's appearance as the big man in black came up through the rubble, his intent eyes emitting pale beams of light. Calmly, he strode through the rising mob to the entrance of Robin Wensberry's flat. His iron control gave him an air of detachment. If she's dead, he thought, I'm finished. I've got to use her. But if she's dead... Robin's apartment was gutted like the rest of the building. The living room was an oval of floor around the jagged hole in the center. Foyle searched for a body. Two men and a woman were in the bed in the bedroom. The men cursed. The woman shrieked at the apparition. The men hurled themselves at Foyle. He backed a step and pressed his tongue against his upper incisors. Neural circuits buzzed, and every sense of response in his body was accelerated by a factor of 5. The effect was an instantaneous reduction of the external world to extreme slow motion. Sound became a deep garble. Color shifted down the spectrum to the red. The two assailants seemed to float toward him with dreamlike languor. To the rest of the world, Foyle became a blur of action. He sidestepped the blow, inching toward him, walked around the man, raised him, and threw him toward the crater in the living room. He threw the second man after the first jackal. To Foyle's accelerated senses, their bodies seemed to drift slowly, still in mid-stride, fists inching forward, open mouths emitting heavy, clotted sounds. Foyle whipped to the woman cowering in the bed. Where's their body? The blur asked. The woman shrieked. Foyle pressed his upper incisors again, cutting off the acceleration. The external world shook itself out of slow motion back to normal. Sound and color leaped up the spectrum, and the two jackals disappeared through the crater and crashed into the apartment below. Was there a body? Foyle repeated gently. A Negro girl. The woman was unintelligible. He took her by the hair and shook her, then hurled her through the crater in the living room floor. His search for a clue to Robin's fate was interrupted by the mob from the hall. They carried torches and makeshift weapons. The jack-jaunters were not professional killers. They only worried defenseless prey to death. Don't bother me, Foyle warned quietly, ferreting intently through closets and under overturned furniture. They edged closer, goaded by a ruffian in a mink suit and a tri-cornered hat, and inspired by the curses percolating up from the floor below. The man in the tricorn threw a torch at Foyle. It burned him. Foyle accelerated again, and the jack-jaunters were transformed into living statues. Foyle picked up half a chair and calmly clubbed the slow-motion figures. They remained upright. He thrust the man in the tricorn down on the floor and knelt on him. Then he decelerated. Again the external world came to life. The jackals dropped in their tracks, pole-axed. The man in the tricorn hat and mink suit roared. Was there a body in here? Foyle asked. Negro girl. Very tall. Very beautiful. The man writhed and attempted to gouge Foyle's eyes. You keep track of bodies, Foyle said gently. Some of you jacks like dead girls better than live ones. Did you find her body in here? Receiving no satisfactory answer, he picked up a torch and set fire to the mink suit. He followed the jack-jaunter into the living room and watched him with detached interest. The man howled, toppled over the edge of the crater, and flamed down into the darkness below. Was there a body? Foyle called down quietly. He shook his head at the answer. Not very deft, he murmured. I've got to learn how to extract information. Dagenham could teach me a thing or two. He switched off his electronic system and jaunted. He appeared in Green Bay, smelling so abominably of singed hair and scorched skin that he entered the local pristine shop, jewels, perfumes, cosmetics, ionics, and surrogates, to buy a deodorant. But the local Mr. Presto had evidently witnessed the arrival of the 4 Mile Circus and recognized him. Foyle at once awoke from his detached intensity and became the outlandish 4 Mile of Ceres. He clowned and cavorted, bought a 12-ounce flagon of Urge No. 5 at 100 credits the ounce, dabbed himself delicately, and tossed the bottle into the street, to the edification and delight of Mr. Presto. The record clerk at the county record office was unaware of Foyle's identity, and was obdurate and uncompromising. No, sir. County records are not viewed without proper court order for sufficient cause. That must be final. Foyle examined him keenly and without rancor. Asthenic type, he decided. Slender, long-boned, no strength. Epileptoid character. Self-centered, pedantic, single-minded, shallow. Not bribable. Too repressed and straight-laced. But repression's the chink in his armor. An hour later, six followers from the four-mile circus waylaid the record clerk. They were of the female persuasion and richly endowed with vice. 2 hours later, the record clerk, dazed by flesh and the devil, delivered up his information. The apartment building had been opened to Jack Jaunting by a gas explosion 2 weeks earlier. All tenants had been forced to move. Robin Wensbury was in protective confinement in Mercy Hospital near the Iron Mountain Proving Grounds.
Protective confinement? Foyle wondered. What for? What's she done?
It took 30 minutes to organize a Christmas party in the four-mile circus. It was made up of musicians, singers, actors, and rabble who knew the Iron Mountain coordinates. Led by their chief buffoon, they jaunted up with music, fireworks, firewater, and gifts. They paraded through the town, spreading largesse and laughter. They blundered into the radar field of the Proving Ground Protection System and were driven out with laughter. 4 miles of Ceres, dressed as Santa Claus, scattering banknotes from a huge sack over his shoulder and leaping in agony as the induction field of the protection system burned his bottom, made an entrancing spectacle. They burst into Mercy Hospital, following Santa Claus, who roared and cavorted with the detached calm of a solemn elephant. He kissed the nurses, made drunk the attendants, pestered the patients with gifts, littered the corridors with money, and abruptly disappeared when the happy rioting reached such heights that the police had to be called. Much later, it was discovered that a patient had disappeared too, despite the fact that she had been under sedation and was incapable of jaunting. As a matter of fact, she departed from the hospital inside Santa's sack. Foyle jaunted with her over his shoulder to the hospital grounds. There, in a quiet grove of pines under a frosty sky, he helped her out of the sack. She wore severe white hospital pajamas and was beautiful. He removed his own costume, watching the girl intently, waiting to see if she would recognize him and remember him. She was alarmed and confused. Her telescending was like heat lightning.
My God, who is he? What's happened? The music, the uproar. Why kidnapped in a sack? Drunk slurring on trombones. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Adeste fidelis. What's he want from me? Who is he?
I'm 4 miles of Ceres, Foyle said.
What? Who? 4 miles of... Yes, of course. The buffoon. The bourgeois gentilhomme. Vulgarity. Imbecility. Obscenity. The 4 miles circus. My God, am I telescending? Can you hear me?
I hear you, Miss Wensbury, Foyle said quietly.
What have you done? Why? What do you want with me? I
want you to look at me.
Bonjour, madame. Into my sack, madame. Echo. Look at me.
I'm looking, Robin said, trying to control the jangle of her thoughts. She gazed up into his face without recognition.
It's a face. I've seen so many like it. The faces of men, oh God. The features of masculinity. Every man in rut. Will God never save us from brute desire?
My rutting season's over, Miss Wensbury.
I'm sorry you heard that. I'm terrified, naturally. You know me?
I know you.
We've met before.
She scrutinized him closely, but still without recognition. Deep down inside Foyle, there was a surge of triumph. If this woman, of all women, failed to remember him, he was safe. Provided he kept blood and brains and face under control.
We've never met, he said. I've heard of you. I want something from you. That's why we're here, to talk about it. If you don't like my offer, you can go back to the hospital.
You want something? But I've got nothing. Nothing. Nothing's left but shame and
Oh, God, why did the suicide fail? Why couldn't I...
So that's it, Foyle interrupted softly. You tried to commit suicide, huh? That accounts for the gas explosion that opened the building and your protective confinement. Attempted suicide. Why weren't you hurt in the explosion?
So many were hurt. So many died. But I didn't. I'm unlucky, I suppose. I've been unlucky all my life.
Why suicide?
I'm tired. I'm finished. I've lost everything. I'm on the Army gray list. Suspected, watched, reported. No job, no family, no... Why suicide? Dear God, what else but suicide?
You can work for me.
I can... What did you say?
I want you to work for me, Miss Wednesbury.
She burst into hysterical laughter.
For you? Another camp follower in a circus. Work for you, Fourmile?
You've got sex on the brain, he said gently. I'm not looking for tarts. They look for me, as a rule.
I'm sorry. I'm obsessed by the brute who destroyed me.
I'll try to make sense, Robin calmed herself. Let me understand you. You've taken me out of the hospital to offer me a job. You've heard of me. That means you want something special. My specialty is telescending.
And charm.
What?
I want to buy your charm, Miss Wednesbury.
I don't understand.
Why, Foyle said mildly, it ought to be simple for you. I'm the buffoon. I'm vulgarity, imbecility, obscenity. That's got to stop. I want you to be my social secretary.
You expect me to believe that? You could hire 100 social secretaries, 1,000 with your money. You expect me to believe that I'm the only one for you? That you had to kidnap me from protective confinement to get me?
Foyle nodded. That's right. There are thousands. But only one that can telescend.
What's that got to do with it?
You're going to be the ventriloquist. I'm going to be your dummy. I don't know the upper classes. You do. They have their own talk, their own jokes, their own manners. If a man wants to be accepted by them, he's got to talk their language. I can't. But you can. You'll talk for me, through my mouth.
But you could learn.
No, it would take too long. And charm can't be learned. I want to buy your charm, Miss Wednesbury. Now, about salary. I'll pay you $1,000 a month. Her eyes widened.
You're very generous, Fourmile.
I'll clean up the suicide charge for you.
You're very kind.
And I'll guarantee to get you off the Army gray list. You'll be back on the white list by the time you finish working for me. You can start with a clean slate and a bonus. You can start living again.
Robin's lips trembled, and then she began to cry. She sobbed and shook, and Foyle had to steady her.
Well, he asked, will you do it?
She nodded.
You're so kind. I'm not used to kindness anymore.
The dull concussion of a distant explosion made Foyle stiffen.
Christ! He exclaimed in sudden panic. Another blue jaunt!
No, Robin said. I don't know what blue jaunt is, but that's the proving ground that... She looked up at Foyle's face and screamed. The unexpected shock of the explosion and the vivid chain of associations had wrenched loose his iron control. The blood-red scars of tattooing showed under his skin. She stared at him in horror, still screaming. He touched his face once, then leaped forward and gagged her. Once again, he had hold of himself.
It shows, eh? He murmured with a ghastly smile. Lost my grip for a minute. Thought I was back in Jouffre Martel listening to a blue jaunt. Yes, I'm Foyle, the brute who destroyed you. You had to know sooner or later, but I'd hoped it would be later. I'm Foyle, back again. Will you be quiet and listen to me?
She shook her head frantically, trying to struggle out of his grasp. With detached calm, he punched her jaw. Robin sagged. Foyle picked her up, wrapped her in his coat, and held her in his arms, waiting for consciousness to return. When he saw her eyelids flutter, he spoke again.
Don't move or you'll be sick. Maybe I didn't pull that punch enough.
Brute. Beast.
I could do this the wrong way, he said. I could blackmail you. I know your mother and sisters are on Callisto.
that you're classed as an alien belligerent by association. That puts you on the blacklist, ipso facto. Is that right? Ipso facto, by the very fact? Latin. You can't trust hypno-learning. I could point out that all I have to do is send anonymous information to Central Intelligence, and you wouldn't be just suspect anymore. They'd be ripping information out of you inside 12 hours. He felt her shudder. But I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to tell you the truth, because I want to turn you into a partner. Your mother's in the inner planets. She's in the inner planets, he repeated. She may be on Terra.
Safe? She whispered.
I don't know.
Put me down.
You're cold.
Put me down.
He set her on her feet.
You destroyed me once, she said in choked tones. Are you trying to destroy me again?
No. Will you listen? She nodded. I was lost in space. I was dead and rotting for 6 months. A ship came up that could have saved me. It passed me by. It let me die. A ship named Vorga. Vorga-T:1339. Does that mean anything to you?
No.
Jiz McQueen, a friend of mine who's dead now, once told me to find out why I was left to rot. That would be the answer to who gave the order. So I started buying information about Vorga. Any information.
What's that to do with my mother?
Just listen. Information was tough to buy. The Vorga records were removed from the Bonas and Urg files. I managed to locate three names, three out of a standard crew of 4 officers and 12 men. Nobody knew anything or nobody would talk. And I found this. Foyle took a silver locket from his pocket and handed it to Robin. It was pawned by some spaceman off the Vorga. That's all I could find out.
Robin uttered a cry and opened the locket with trembling fingers. Inside was her picture, and the pictures of 2 other girls. As the locket was opened, the 3D photos smiled and whispered,
Love from Robin, Mama. Love from Holly, Mama. Love from Wendy, Mama. It is my mother's, Robin wept. For pity's sake, where is she? What happened?
I don't know, Foyle said steadily, but I can guess. I think your mother got out of that concentration camp, one way or another.
And my sisters, too. She'd never leave them.
Maybe your sisters, too. I think Vorga was running refugees out of Callisto. Your family paid with money and jewelry to get aboard and be taken to the inner planets. That's how a spaceman off the Vorga came to pawn this locket.
Then where are they?
I don't know. Maybe they were dumped on Mars or Venus. Most probably they were sold to a labor camp on the moon, which is why they haven't been able to get in touch with you. I don't know where they are, but Vorga can tell us.
Are you lying? Tricking me?
Is that locket a lie? I'm telling the truth. All the truth I know. I want to find out why they left me to die and who gave the order. The man who gave the order will know where your mother and sisters are. He'll tell you before I kill him. He'll have plenty of time. He'll be a long time dying.
Robin looked at him in horror. The passion that gripped him was making his face once again show the scarlet stigmata. He looked like a tiger closing in for the kill.
I've got a fortune to spend. Never mind how I got it. I've got 3 months to finish the job. I've learned enough maths to compute the probabilities. 3 months is the outside before they figure that 4 mile of Ceres is Gully Foyle. 90 days. From New Year's to All Fools. Will you join me?
You? Robin cried with loathing. Join you?
All this 4 mile circus is camouflage. Nobody ever suspects a clown. But I've been studying, learning, preparing for the finish. All I need now is you.
Why?
I don't know where the hunt is going to lead me, society or slums. I've got to be prepared for both. The slums I can handle alone. I haven't forgotten the gutter. But I need you for society. Will you come in with me?
You're hurting me.
Robin wrenched her arm out of Foyle's grasp.
Sorry. I lose control when I think about Vorga. Will you help me find Vorga and your family?
I hate you, Robin burst out. I despise you. You're rotten. You destroy everything you touch. Someday I'll pay you back.
But we work together from New Year's to All Fools?
We work together.
Chapter 9. On New Year's Eve, Geoffrey Fourmile of Ceres made his onslaught on society. He appeared first in Canberra at the Government House Ball half an hour before midnight. This was a highly formal affair, bursting with color and pageantry, for it was the custom at formals for society to wear the evening dress that had been fashionable the year its clan was founded, or its trademark patented. Thus, the Morses, telephone and telegraph, wore 19th-century frock coats, and their women wore Victorian hoop skirts. The Skodas, powder and guns, harked back to the late 18th century, wearing Regency tights and crinolines. The daring Peenemundas, rockets and reactors, dating from the 1920s, wore tuxedos, and their women unashamedly revealed legs, arms, and necks in the décolleté of antique worth and mamboche gowns. Fourmile of Ceres appeared in evening clothes, very modern and very black, relieved only by a white sunburst on his shoulder, the trademark of the Ceres clan. With him was Robin Winsbury, in a glittering white gown, her slender waist tight in whalebone, the bustle of the gown accentuating her long, straight back and graceful step. The black and white contrast was so arresting that an orderly was sent to check the sunburst trademark in the almanac of peerages and patents. He returned with the news that it was of the Ceres Mining Company, organized in 2250 for the exploitation of the mineral resources of Ceres, Pallas, and Vesta. The resources had never manifested themselves, and the House of Ceres had gone into eclipse, but had never become extinct. Apparently, it was now being revived.
Fourmile? The clown? Yes, the Fourmile Circus. Everybody's talking about him.
Is that the same man?
Couldn't be. He looks human.
Society clustered around Fourmile, curious but wary.
Here they come,
Foyle muttered to Robin.
Relax. They want the light touch. They'll accept anything if it's amusing. Stay tuned.
Are you that dreadful man with the circus, Fourmile?
Sure you are. Smile.
I am, madam. You may touch me.
Why, you actually seem proud. Are you proud of your bad taste?
The problem today is to have any taste at all.
The problem today is to have any taste at all. I think I'm lucky.
Lucky, but dreadfully indecent.
Indecent, but not dull.
And dreadful, but delightful. Why aren't you cavorting now?
I'm under the influence, madam.
Oh, dear, are you drunk? I'm Lady Shrapnel. When will you be sober again?
I'm under your influence, Lady Shrapnel.
You wicked young man. Charles, come here and save a Fourmile. I'm ruining him.
That's Victor of RCA, Victor.
Fourmile, is it? Delighted. What's that entourage of yours cost?
Tell him the truth.
40,000, Victor. Good Lord, a week? A day? A day? What on earth do you want to spend all that money for?
The truth.
For notoriety, Victor. Huh. Are you serious?
I told you he was wicked, Charles.
Damned refreshing. Klaus, here a moment. This impudent young man is spending 40,000 a day. For notoriety, if you please.
Skoda of Skoda.
Good evening, Fourmile. I am much interested in this revival of the name. You are perhaps a cadet descendant of the original founding board of Ceres Incorporated?
Give him the truth.
No, Skoda. It's a title by purchase. I bought the company. I'm an upstart.
Good. Toujours de l'audace.
My word, Fourmile, you're frank. Told you he was impudent.
Very refreshing. There's a parcel of damned upstarts about young man, but they don't admit it. Elizabeth, come and meet Fourmile of Ceres.
Fourmile, I've been dying to meet you.
Lady Elizabeth Citroën.
Is it true you travel with a portable college?
The light touch here.
A portable high school, Lady Elizabeth.
But why on earth, Fourmile?
Oh, madam, it's so difficult to spend money these days. We have to find the silliest excuses. If only someone would invent a new extravagance.
You ought to travel with a portable inventor, Fourmile.
I've got one, haven't I, Robin? But he wastes his time on perpetual motion. What I need is a resident spendthrift. Would any of your clans care to lend me a younger son?
Would any of us care to? There's many a clan would pay for the privilege of unloading.
Isn't perpetual motion spendthrift enough for you, Fourmile?
No.
It's a shocking waste of money. The whole point of extravagance is to act like a fool and feel like a fool. But enjoy it. Where's the joy in perpetual motion? Is there any extravagance in entropy? Millions for nonsense, but not 1 cent for entropy. My slogan.
They laughed, and the crowd clustering around 4 Mile grew. They were delighted and amused. He was a new toy. Then it was midnight, and as the great clock tolled in the new year, the gathering prepared to jaunt with midnight around the world.
Come with us to Java, 4 Mile. Regis Sheffield's giving a marvelous legal party. We're going to play Sober the Judge.
Hong Kong, 4 Mile.
Tokyo, 4 Mile. It's raining in Hong Kong. Come to Tokyo and bring your circus.
Thank you, no. Shanghai, for me. The Soviet Duomo. I promise an extravagant reward to the first one who discovers the deception of my costume. Meet you all in 2 hours. Ready, Robin?
Don't jaunt. Bad manners. Walk out. Slowly. Languor is chic. Respect to the governor, to the commissioner, their ladies. Bien. Don't forget to tip the attendants. Not him, idiot. That's the lieutenant governor. All right, you made a hit. You're accepted. Now what?
Now what we came to Canberra for.
I thought we came for the ball.
The ball and a man named Forrest.
Who's that?
Ben Forrest. Spaceman off the Vorga. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.